सहना भवतु सहनो भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा द्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. May the Supreme Lord protect both the teacher and the student, and may He cherish and nourish us both. May we work with full energy, may our study be perfect, and may it give us good results. May we never feel ill will towards others. Okay, so today we're going to finish chapter 5. We're looking at only 3 verses, but they're very significant verses. Verses 27-29. In previous verses, Krishna has been explaining to Arjuna how to achieve perfection through Buddha Yoga. However, Arjuna's mind stubbornly argues that actually renunciation and inaction is better. So now in verses 27-28, Krishna will begin applying a new preaching strategy. It's very interesting what he's doing here. He's introducing Arjuna to Ashtanga Yoga. Now, it's very interesting that Ashtanga Yoga, basically, although it's 8 aspects to it, there are 2 main parts to it in terms of process. One part is called Yoga Rurukshu. I write these terms on the board. And Yoga Ruda. So, Arjuna is saying, no, I'll just go to the forest. I don't want to fight. I'd rather just renounce. So now Krishna is going to tell him, that's fine, but if you want to renounce in the appropriate way, if you want to really go to the forest and do things properly, then you'll have to practice Ashtanga Yoga. And Ashtanga Yoga starts with Yoga Rurukshu, which means you're starting to follow the basic principles of Ashtanga Yoga, Hatha, you know, the asanas and this kind of thing. But a very important part of that work is working with attachment. Even to practice Ashtanga Yoga, you have to, first of all, because the mind is impure, it can't concentrate or meditate, so it has to be purified. So in the beginning stages of Ashtanga Yoga, there is also detached work. And then when we become very, very elevated and the mind is completely controlled, then we can practice Yoga Ruddha. But that life is very, very austere. So we will see in chapter 6, pardon? Yoga Ruddha is the higher stages where your mind is fixed enough and pure enough that you can just concentrate on Paramatma or Brahman. So in these verses 27-28, these are an introduction to chapter 6. Krishna is planting the seed of, okay, so now we're going to talk about Ashtanga Yoga. It's worth remembering at this point in time that Krishna, we may be thinking because of all of the arrangements that Krishna is making to make his preaching effective, we may start to think he's just doing like this because he wants to convince Arjuna to fight. Isn't it? He's going to so much trouble explaining it from this side, explaining it from that side. Isn't it? So we may start to think that he's doing like this. He's using the philosophy to convince Arjuna to fight. Those of us who have been around for many years have had experience of this use of philosophy. Isn't it? But there's a very interesting thing about Krishna. He explains himself in 1863. He says, okay, I've told you everything. I've explained the most confidential knowledge. Now I want you to think about it. I want you to deliberate on it and make up your mind what you want to do. This is first class preaching. He's concerned not to convince the person to do what he wants him to do. He's concerned that the person understand everything, understand the reality, and then make up his mind what he feels is best to do. This is a very essential point in good preaching and good management. So let's have a look at these verses. In 27-28, Krishna is starting to talk about Astanga Yoga. His reasoning is that if he gives Arjuna the facts about bona fide practices that center around renunciation, he'll stop being whimsical and sentimental and start to see things as they are and make his decision based on the facts rather than thinking, oh, renunciation, that would be better. But at this point in time, it's just a sentimental, whimsical idea. He doesn't really know what he's talking about. So Krishna is saying, okay, let's tell him what the practice is about. And these two verses are the beginning of a whole chapter that Krishna will give to explaining to Arjuna exactly how he's going to have to do it if he is going to practice this kind of renunciation. And then at the end of chapter 6, what does Arjuna say? I can't do this. I can't do it. He knows the facts and he decides, I can't do it. Why isn't it for Arjuna to practice Astanga Yoga? It's an artificial and mechanical way of controlling the mind and senses, and it doesn't always work. Arjuna already has a loving relationship with Krishna. He's practicing spontaneous devotional service in loving relationship with Krishna. So why should he step down into trying to artificially control the senses and the mind? Makes no sense. Srila Prabhupada explains the futility of such four-sense control and the superiority of sense control in Krishna consciousness very simply in a Bhagavad Gita lecture he gave in New York City in 66. I'd like to share it with you. It's a very nice points that Prabhupada is making here. Very simple but very powerful. Let's comment on 27 and 28. Now this yoga practice is to withdraw the senses from the sense object. But the bhakti yoga process is that if I do not like to see artificially the beauty of man or woman, if I try to see the beauty of Krishna, naturally this propensity of seeing beautiful man or woman becomes extinguished. You do not require to shut your eyes. There are so many beautiful girls sitting here. I do not require to shut my eyes. If my mind is concentrated on the beauty of Krishna, I can see these beautiful girls as Krishna's gopis. That is another vision. So artificially, if I close my eyes, and if some beautiful girl is in my imagination, even after closing my eyes, what is the use of closing my eyes? So by force, you cannot control the senses. No, there are many instances. Even great yogis, they have failed. This is artificial way of controlling the senses. The real sense control is that you purify your senses in the activities of Krishna consciousness. This is from a class Prabhupada gave in New York City in 66. On verses 26-29. It's very nicely stated. Verse 27 is a very famous verse. It's Krishna's transcendental peace formula. I'd like to read the verse as well as a couple of sections from Prabhupada's purport. So let's have a look at chapter 5, last verse. We'll read the verse first. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the supreme lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. A couple of things from Prabhupada's purport that are very strong points. We'll start from the beginning. The conditioned souls within the clutches of illusory energy are all anxious to attain peace in the material world, but they do not know the formula for peace, which is explained in this part of Bhagavad Gita. The greatest peace formula is simply this:
Lord Krishna is a beneficiary in all human activities. Men should offer everything to the transcendental service of the Lord, because he is the proprietor of all planets and the demigods thereon. No one is greater than him or than he. Then seven lines down, the Lord is the master of material nature, and the conditioned souls are under the stringent rules of material nature. Unless one understands these bare facts, it is not possible to achieve peace in the world, either individually or collectively. This is the sense of Krishna consciousness. Lord Krishna is the supreme predominator, and all living entities, including the great demigods, are his subordinates. One can attain perfect peace only in complete Krishna consciousness. Now, I'd like to elaborate on this quite a lot, because it's a kind of point that if we don't think about it deeply and look at it from different angles of vision, it may be that kind of aspect of the philosophy that we present blindly. We may not completely understand what Krishna is saying. Sounds like a good idea, but we're not really sure. So I'm thinking we'll look at it from different angles of vision to increase our awareness of what Prabhupada and Krishna are actually saying. Let's have a look, first of all, at the Suradam Sabhabhutanam. Krishna is a friend of all living entities. So there's a very nice point that he makes in a lecture he gave in Seattle in 68. Sorry, that's a misreference. It's from New York City, 66. So here Prabhupada says, therefore those who are actually saintly person, they simply depend on Krishna. Why? If Krishna is supplying food to the elephant, beginning from the elephant to the ant, why not to me? I am engaged in his service. He is so ungrateful. If you serve, if you render some service somewhere, he pays you, gives you some wages. So if you are engaged in Krishna's service, do you think he will starve? Why? You cannot starve. He is a well-wisher of all living entities. Why not for you? This confidence must be there. If he is well-wisher for everyone, and I am engaged in his service, is he not my well-wisher? So we should simply depend on Krishna. We shall simply exert all our energies for the service of Krishna. Everything will be all right. This understanding is called surrender. This is called confidence in Krishna. Krishna will supply everything. Let me engage in his service. He is well-wisher. Attain peace from the pangs of material miseries. And those who are not confident that Krishna will protect me, they are in misery. Oh, what shall I eat? Where shall I live? What shall I do? How can I protect? They are always thinking. Therefore, the other day, I cited the verse from Yamuna Acharya, Bhavatam eva chiram nirantaram prashantam nishesha gato rahan. Just like the child is in the lap of the mother and is confident that my comfort, my food, my dress, everything is there because my mother is there. So natural. Not only human being, even cats and dogs. Where mother is there, everything is there. Child is knowing. My protection is there. This is confidence. As soon as one grows, keeps away from the mother, from the father, life of so-called independence, then the problem. Actually, we are dependent on Krishna. He is supplier. He is giving us food, everything. So we must have confidence. There's also a very beautiful statement that Prabhupada made in a Vrindavan lecture. Actually, it was a Bhagavatam lecture, 1225 in 72 in Vrindavan. It was on this verse, mentions this verse. But Krishna, he is friend of everyone. You have seen Krishna's picture? He's embracing the calf also. And he's embracing Radharani. Not that he's simply attached to Radharani and the gopis. He's attached to everyone, every living entity. Therefore, Krishna is the best friend of everyone. So if you want friendship, you make friendship with Krishna. And because he's a proprietor, he can protect you. These are the 3 points. Is that clear? Or have you got any question? You can question. Let it be clear. This is a very intelligent question. So if we have to search out a friend, just search out Krishna. Make friendship with Krishna. He'll satisfy you in all respects. And he's not poor. Bhaktaram yagna tapasam sarva loka maheshwaram. He's a proprietor of everything. What do you want? Everything will be supplied. He's so nice friend. So if you understand these 3 points about Krishna, then life becomes successful. There's 2 other points that I'd like to, or one actually, that I'd like to read to you from Burajan Prabhu's Surrender Unto Me in relation to this also. It's also, he's quoting here a lecture from Srila Prabhupada, given in 68. It's on page 125, if you'd like to have a look at it later. This is also looking at the aspect of Krishna being the best friend of living entities. I particularly like this because he's quoting from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, where he explains the different Sanskrit words for different kinds of friends. Yeah? So the really close, intimate friend is a suradam. There are other kinds of names for different kinds of less intimate friends. Let's have a read. Krishna is always our natural friend. That is stated in Bhagavad Gita, suradam sarva bhutanam. Suradam means surit. There are different names in Sanskrit for different kinds of friends. One friend is called bandhu, one is called mitra, and one is called surit. So Krishna says, I am surit, which means such a good friend, a friend who sincerely wants your happiness. A surit is a real friend. A mitra is a social friend. Interesting. Mitra is a social friend. Bandhu is official friendship. But surit means one actually desires good for his friend. Sincere friend. Krishna is surit. He is always wishing my good, and he is therefore canvassing to me, please, you surrender to me. Just like the father says, my dear boy, why are you acting so independently? Foolishing your suffering. Just surrender unto me. I shall give you protection. Similarly, Krishna is a friend like a father. He's always asking, and he is going with me in every type of body. Even if I get the body of a dog, Krishna is always there with me. Even if I'm with a cat, dog, hogs, or any type of lower body, he has no hesitation. He is so friendly that wherever his friend is going, he also goes there. As Paramatma, he is doing friendly activities. He is sending his bona fide servant as spiritual master. He is coming as incarnations, and he is coming as a devotee, Lord Chaitanya. He is helping us in so many ways. But we are so foolish, we are not accepting him. Nobody can be a better friend than Krishna. But we are so much unfortunate, so much captivated by the external energy, that we don't accept Krishna as our friend. That's deep. This is actually the one that's quoted from the Seattle lecture. I confused the two. So this is from Seattle 128. 125. So just a few thoughts that I wanted to share with you on these verses. I feel that we could explore the peace formula quite a lot, and I had intended to do that, but let's see how we go with questions. Any questions on what we've spoken so far? I've just taken it from what the Acharyas have said, as it's given by Burajan Prabhu. I haven't looked deeper into it. It's probably in the Niti Shastra, I would suggest. It's that kind of... It's probably in the Niti Shastra. Niti Shastra, yeah. That talks a lot about social dealings and law and order and all that kind of thing. Kshatriya code, basically. you may have a position and there is somebody that you need to get on with for your duties to be done properly. So you maintain a friendship for that reason, although you have nothing in common. Krishna's not saying that. He may be thinking that. He's not saying it. But it's obvious, I was talking at that point from Arjuna's point of view, that when he's presented with the facts of what he's going to do what he's saying he wants to do, then it's not going to have any taste, because he's already doing something far higher. He also already has an intimate relationship with Krishna. So, you know, when Krishna presents him with all the facts and fears in chapter 6, you know, and leaves it to him to decide, so I can't do that. At this point, Arjuna is playing the part of a conditioned soul. So he's pretty much covered. If he wasn't, then it would be very difficult for this conversation, this dialogue, to go along with real meaning. There is, I have heard, but have never had the good fortune to read, commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, where Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains the dialogue that's going on in between the verses, where it's clear that Arjuna is not bewildered and he's not, why are you putting me in this situation? Why are you asking me these questions? Why are you explaining this philosophy? I'm your Nityasiddha devotee. What are you doing this for? But I've never had the good fortune to read it, so I can't comment on it. Oh, that point. Actually, what is his actual situation will become very apparent in the 11th chapter. That he is not really thinking of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's just his worshipable friend, his dearest associate. So then when Krishna shows his universal form in the 11th chapter, Arjuna becomes very, very fearful, very, very bewildered. So you can understand that in usual circumstances, he's not thinking of Krishna as being the all in all or being God. He's thinking of him as a very intimate and dear associate. That would be my understanding. Is it okay? You have a different idea? Yeah. You see, if he actually was always thinking of Krishna as God, then in the 11th chapter, he wouldn't be apologizing for joking while sitting on the same bed, you know, sleeping together, eating together. He wouldn't be apologizing for that. No, he's actually accepted him as guru. He's accepted him as guru. He's hearing from him in that light. He's hearing. Anybody got any ideas on that? But we haven't got that far yet. We're only talking up to chapter 5. Yashoda is explaining by giving an example that perhaps you are a teacher in a school, and your son is studying in that school. Now his primary relationship with you is mother and son. But there will be a slightly different circumstance in the school situation because of the circumstance. The mood and everything will be a little bit different. It's an interesting way of looking at it. So then we're looking at it in terms of the mood. Yeah. For us, I mean, it's taking us over 4 months to study Bhagavad Gita, but Krishna spoke it to Arjuna in about 45, 47 minutes. So it's, in terms of how long he was in this state, it's very, very short. And he was put into that state for our benefit by Krishna. So, you know, because we're studying it over 4 months, it seems like Arjuna is bewildered for a long time. But actually, he's less than an hour, he's bewildered. And then he pulls out of it and understands he's not the doer and goes on with being Krishna's instrument and servant. Yeah, Krishna completely covers it again. Yeah, similar kind of thing. That's basically, we're talking about an arousing of spiritual consciousness. So that, as the next sentence, the more one is advanced, the more he is freed from the clutches of matter. So this is not an external thing, but rather just by the potency of the consciousness that we are not seeing things separate from Krishna anymore. We're seeing things more and more in harmony with Krishna, as part and parcel of Krishna. So then, you know, it's not matter anymore. It's Krishna's energy. And we can understand how to utilize it without getting, you know what is that saying? Catching the fish without getting wet? Actually, yeah, this is a good point. And Krishna has been making this point since chapter 2, that the essence is to spiritualize our consciousness. The externals are so not so much the emphasis is there. The important thing is the state of our consciousness. We all know that, isn't it? We have personal experience of that. We can be doing the same thing every day, but our experience every day is different according to the level of consciousness we're in on a particular day. Tapasvini is really sick today. So, you know, her experience of class today is different than it was yesterday. She's not fired up today. She's thinking about a headache, got a stomach ache, you know, her chest is, you know. So it's a different experience. Consciousness is more covered by being ill. So we all have regular experience of this, isn't it? We may be doing the same. We may be going to Mangalati every morning. We may be chanting 16 rounds a day every day. The experience every day is not the same. What's the different thing, the different element? It's the consciousness. How the modes are affecting us, you know, like that. So Krishna has been, and Prabhupada, especially Prabhupada, has been stressing this since chapter 2. But as you say, here he is giving us a little bit of a glimpse into how to make our consciousness a little bit more elevated. If we can accept these three things. You remember when we did that theme, the demigod worshippers? If we have that kind of mentality, that we want more than we're due, and we figure that we have to get it, we don't trust Krishna will give it, or we, you know, that if that mentality is there, it's like a tinge of the demigod mood, you know, demigod worshipper mood. So if we have that in us, then Krishna will give us faith in our own capacity to provide for ourselves, give us faith in our husband that he will provide, give us faith in the government that we'll get dole from them, you know, like that. But he will give that faith. If that's your level of consciousness and that's what you can deal with, he's not a sadist, he's not going to make life tough for you. If that's what you can manage now, then okay, he'll give you faith. But then as you start to develop in your consciousness, you start to doubt that that is actually the best way to deal with things. Or you even just decide it's time to try and develop your relationship with Krishna. Then he'll put you in circumstances which will cause you to doubt that that's the best way to do it. And to think that let me try and depend on Krishna. Let me try and depend on Krishna. And then amazing things happen. Most Sankirtan devotees can tell you amazing stories of what has happened when they've depended on Krishna. You know, I'm sure, Avadhut, you have any stories you'd like to tell us?
Yeah.
So it's one of the benedictions of doing Sankirtan, is you experience so much the potency of Krishna and the care of Krishna. I know when I was in Australia doing so much book distribution, and I was doing it basically alone, half the state, half a country, just traveling constantly with books. I had so many experiences. I remember one time I was traveling between Brisbane and Rockhampton. That highway is called Horror Highway because there's, you know, murders there and all sorts of nasty things happen there, you know. And I was traveling alone, had a van full of books, and I used to always travel that route to make sure I got, you know, covered from there to there in the daylight because it was pretty heavy. And this particular time, it's out in the middle of nowhere, it's almost desert. And particular time, a tire blew in the middle of nowhere, you know. So I managed to get that tire changed, but then the spare blew. And there's just nobody around on this highway. So I had to spend the night on that highway. And it was very early morning, about 2 a.m. And suddenly I saw all these lights coming from behind, this group of bikies, you know. They're pretty nasty looking guys. Anyway, there's a whole like herd of them. I don't know, they've been out on the town, you know, so they're just coming through. And they saw the car and they stopped. They walked over to the car and knocking on the window. I always used to have the swinger leg on the middle of the steering wheel. So I was thinking, well, what am I going to do? Okay, well, I might as well die preaching. I have plenty of books. So I ran down the window, and it was the most, you know, they're like really heavy, nasty-looking guys. But they saw the situation, and one of them said, "Any way we can help you, love?" It's an amazing experience. And then I was in the middle of nowhere. There was no way I could get the two tires fixed. And those men, they're bikies. You know, they're drunk. They took the two tires. I didn't have any money. They took books to swap, you know, fixing the tires. They went into the next town, fixed the two tires, gave the books for the tires to be fixed, came back, and then they took books. And you have so many experiences. And that's what it's so wonderful about Sankirtan, that you actually get to know Krishna as a person who actually does care. And he puts you into all sorts of interesting situations where you're really forced to depend on him and have a good life at the same time. So I'm sure we've got a lot of stories we could share. Anyone else like to share a story? Yeah, I had a similar experience, same kind of thing with the potency of Nrisingadev. That's a good one. We had a similar experience when we were doing Harinam in Australia. And there was this, you know, like, hotel that you would go past regularly. And there was always guys there that, you know, they'd break bottles and they'd do all sorts, you know, like, throw them at the devotees and do all sorts of really horrible things. And this particular night, it was a really rough group. And they were actually encircling us. So that there was a lot of women that night, there were not so many men. And then the devotee who was in charge of the group, he had the presence of mind. He said, "Everybody sit down, and we're just going to sing the Sringadev prayers." And we just started singing the Sringadev prayers very, very loudly. And they dispersed. They just dispersed. I mean, we were all so frightened. The potency of the Sringadev just cleared them. Okay, so let's go on to the theme. What I've tried to do in the study of our themes is to tie them in with chapters which have already made the theme quite apparent, so that it's not a lot of extra work for us. So this particular theme that we're looking at today is something that we've been concerned with a lot in Chapter 5. Renunciation of work, or work and devotion. Okay? So it's been pretty much in our discussion throughout this week. This theme is also within the realm of Abhideya, process of devotional service. And if we read through the conceptual flow, we'll get quite a clear idea, in a nutshell, that as we've seen, Arjuna asked questions about this, first in chapter 3, again in chapter 5. Krishna himself, without being asked a question by Arjuna, mentions that work and devotion is better in chapter 6. And then again in chapter 18, Arjuna will ask for a further clarification. So in chapter 3, in these verses 3 to 9, Krishna very clearly explains why renunciation of work is not as good as work and devotion. He explains that abstaining from work doesn't mean freedom from reaction, because you're still going to have to eat, you're still going to have to breathe, walk, drink water, all these things, and they will of course bring reaction. Also that renunciation alone can't bring perfection. Because if you renounce before the heart is pure, then how can you purify it? You've decided you're not going to engage the senses, so what activity can you do that will purify you? Also, it's a jiva's constitutional and conditional nature to be always active. So you tell a small child to sit in the corner for 3 hours, you know, good luck. It's not going to work. So the soul is far more active than a small child. Very active. It's not going to work if you try and restrict the soul. You have to give it engagement. And the last point that he makes in chapter 3 is that if we don't work for Vishnu, then our work will be binding. There won't, there'll be no purification. If we do work for Vishnu, on the other hand, it will be purifying. So, just to point out a few things that are important here, I want to just draw your attention to the last sentence of the conceptual flow. Arjuna gains six clarification in chapter 18, and Krishna's answers leave absolutely no room for speculation. So here we are talking verses 2 to 12. We'll just briefly, or very quickly, read through those so that you get a feeling for them. Krishna really spells it out in these verses. We'll just read the English of the verses themselves. This is verse 2 to 12 in chapter 18. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "The giving up of activities that are based on material desire is what great learned men call the renounced order of life, sannyas. And giving up the results of all activities is what the wise call renunciation. Some learned men declare that all kinds of fruitive activities should be given up as faulty. Yet other sages maintain that acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance should never be abandoned. O best of the Bharatas, now hear my judgment about renunciation. O tiger among men, renunciation is declared in the scriptures to be of three kinds. Acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance are not to be given up. They must be performed. Indeed, sacrifice, charity, and penance purify even the great souls. All these activities should be performed without any attachment or any expectation of result. They should be performed as a matter of duty, O son of Pritha. That is my final opinion." Right? This is Krishna's final opinion. Bear in mind that he also says in this chapter, look, if you haven't understood everything that I've said, or the Acharyas explain his mentality, if you haven't understood anything that I've said here, I'm prepared to speak the whole Gita again. So even though he's saying, this is my final opinion, he's not saying, so therefore you have to accept it, but rather, this is my final opinion, I can explain it further if you don't understand what I've said. Next verse, "Prescribed duties should never be renounced. If one gives up his prescribed duties because of illusion, such renunciation is said to be in the mode of ignorance. Anyone who gives up prescribed duties as troublesome or out of fear of bodily discomfort is said to have renounced in the mode of passion. Such action never leads to the elevation of renunciation. O Arjuna, when one performs his prescribed duty only because it ought to be done and renounces all material association and all attachment to the fruit, his renunciation is said to be in the mode of goodness. The intelligent renouncer, situated in the mode of goodness, neither hateful of inauspicious work nor attached to auspicious work, has no doubts about work. It is indeed impossible for an embodied being to give up all activities, but he who renounces the fruits of action is called one who is truly renounced. For one who is not renounced, the threefold fruits of action, desirable, undesirable, and mixed, accrue after death. But those who are in the renounced order of life have no such result to suffer or enjoy." So Krishna is making it very, very clear, not only that he prefers that we work in devotion rather than renounce work, but he's also clarifying what is the state of our consciousness if we think in this way, mode of goodness, in this way, mode of passion, or in this way, mode of ignorance. I found this pulpit by Prabhupada after I'd finished this book, but I'd like to share it with you because it's very, very relevant, and it really puts things in a nutshell. It's the beginning of the purport to 1849. You can add this to your notes for this theme. We'll just read it for now. This is 1849, beginning of the purport. Real renunciation means that one should always think himself part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, and therefore think that he has no right to enjoy the results of his work. Since he is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, the results of his work must be enjoyed by the Supreme Lord. This is actually Krishna consciousness. It's a very powerful statement by Prabhupada. Yeah. We do have to be conscious of... Basically, we're talking in terms of if we're giving up our prescribed duties out of fear of bodily discomfort. How do we deal with that statement practically? The immediate thing that comes to my mind is that we always have to be conscious of our circumstance and what will facilitate and elevate our consciousness and what will drag it down. For a very simple example, many of the girls got very sick after the last feast. Two of them have amoebic dysentery. They've just gone to the doctors. So it would be improper for them in their state of health, for example, to go to the Vaishnavedika course this weekend. They don't have the health for it, isn't it? So you can just see it. It's just a matter of practicality. Another thing is that as we get older, what we could do on the streets, distributing books on the streets when we're 25, 35, maybe we can't do it at 50. Maybe it's time to reassess what is our prescribed duty. Like that. Another thing that we have as women is we have times of the month when we're indisposed. It's more difficult for the mind, it's more difficult for the body to do things at that time. So maybe we need to make adjustments at that time also. So it's a matter of thinking things out, not in terms of trying to avoid our services, but rather from the angle of how can I protect and increase my Krishna consciousness, my level of consciousness. So if we're, if our mood is that we're trying to improve our consciousness, then we have a fairly good judge of how to deal with the externals, isn't it? The spirit is weak, this body is weak. Goes down to practicality, what we can actually do, how we can best function. Common sense is not so common, it's just a problem. This is part of the aftermath of a misunderstanding of what authority in Krishna consciousness means. That devotees have lost faith in their own ability to make decisions, their own ability to act Krishna consciously without having to run to an authority every 10 minutes. And we have to retrain ourselves so that we gain strength to act as integrated people. We're not robots. We have, Krishna has given us intelligence. He didn't give it to us not to use it. He gave it to us to use. So, but this maturity, is part of the maturing process for the individual and for the society. That we've made mistakes in the past in the way we've dealt with authority and, the guru-disciple situation, so many things. But maturation is coming. And we had the good fortune to be part of that, actually. But this aspect, this common sense, I'd like to look at this a bit further, because we tend to think, our angle on the philosophy is such that quite often it's not common sense. We don't use our common sense. Rather, we think we have misconceptions that mean that we do things backwards. They're not at all common sense. I met a devotee, she's in her 50s, she's unwell. And she came up to me before Mangalarti yesterday, she was so distressed, saying, I'm so giddy and I'm, my arm is so much paining and everything is terrible. And I said, why, because you fasted yesterday? She said, yes, because I fasted yesterday. I said, why you fasted yesterday? She's so sick. She has so many complaints in the body. She's over 50. and she's fasting. Prekarasi. Yeah, but we're talking, you know, I very much appreciate Ananda's point that there's room for common sense. But I don't when I see that I can't push any further. I will push to the limit. That's my nature, passion personified. But, you know, I just decided, I got signs this week that if I do these 2 days of Vaishnavarika, I'm going to be finished next week. I'm not going to be able to teach. So I'm pulling out. I would like to do it, but the body's giving signs. No, you do that, you're going to be on your bed next week. You're not going to be teaching. So, you know, I learned through the school of Holden Knox, I must admit. Yeah. That's why this is a good reason to keep our bhajan as the focus of our lives. Our reading and our chanting, our association with the devotees, keep that as the focus of our lives. And the other things we do to the best of our capacity, but not at the expense of these things. Because we do have like facility and skills that we can use in Krishna consciousness, but as Prabhupada explains in that purport, it's our consciousness that will take us back to Krishna. So that should never be jeopardized. And you know, as we get a bit older, we get some common sense about this. We get some common sense. We're forced to. Drivers have to sleep 8 hours. Yeah, that's common sense from Prabhupada also. Okay, so what do you guys want to do? It's Friday. We can do our usual group work, or you can use the last 15 minutes to copy all this down and fill in your fill-in sheets from the fifth chapter from here.
Oh, what about that thing we began a couple of days ago?
Which one? Mudra Mission?
Mudra Mission.
Aha. Uh-huh. You want to do that now? How many would like to have a look at Mudra Mission now? Looks like Friday itis has got the better of us. Two of you. Okay, we'll try again next week. Okay, so you want to use this last 15 minutes to copy down the things for the fill-in chat?